Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode number 14 of the Driving Eureka podcast, which correlates with Doug Hall's newsletter from January 24th that you can link to at DougHall.com. Click on the menu, newsletters, and you can sign up for the newsletter and also read this week's newsletter as well as the ones that preceded it. This week's feature article, it's time to resist the tyranny of convenience. The Driving Eureka book segment is a new way of learning, cycles to mastery. The Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment is great companies, great distilleries, go deep. And then the classic rocks serve we'll talk about too. So it's time to resist the tyranny of convenience. You really rail against in your newsletter about we got it too good.
Yeah. So I was going through some papers cleaning up after the end of the year, and I found an article titled The Tyranny of Convenience by Tim Wu in the New York Times International Edition. And the closing paragraph said it well. Tim wrote, "So let's reflect on the tyranny of convenience. Try more often to resist its stupefying power and see what happens. We must never forget the joy of doing something slow and something difficult. The satisfaction of not doing what is easiest. The constellation of inconvenient choices may be all that stands between us and a life of total, efficient conformity." I mean, you talk about kind of flushing it here. I mean, he's just saying, you know, our world's just becoming easy. Whether it's a digital world, I can read the snippet. I don't have to read the book. Artificial intelligence, or I need to learn how to do this. So rather than actually learn how to use the saw, I'm going to watch the YouTube video that shows me how to make this one little cut. And I'm going to be, you know, a nanometer deep with no depth of understanding on things. And he really takes a hard position, and I would agree with him, that we don't spend the time to really go deep in things. We take the convenient, less travel path. We don't really force ourselves to really learn something. And so we're disengaged, and we're unexcited, and we're bored. Because we, you know, if we don't know how to do it, we don't start.
So what in essence he's seen, and I assume then, Doug, that you take this narrative that he basically is espousing here, because we have it so convenient, we aren't going deep, that we're going the path of least resistance. On the other hand, you know, when I sit there and I start to read what he's saying is, yeah, but we've worked awfully hard to get here. So, you know, nowadays, and it's funny, be curious of your read on it. But, you know, I sit in these webinars sometimes with different companies. There's one called Teachable, which is a website where you can do, you know, teach something that you know about. But when I listen to the conversations going on, all of these people that are making all types of money teaching something are basically saying, I don't really know that much about it, but I'm going to learn it as I teach it. And I don't know if that's necessarily what it's railing against, but, you know, we have a whole series of things that are being constructed now and on the internet associated with, well, I don't really have that much depth with it, but I'm going to get some depth with it. Is that a bad course then? Or is it, I mean, yeah, the part of me says, shouldn't you know something before you start to teach something, as opposed to learning as I do it? But I've experienced both ways. So in other words, I've started into something with some knowledge, certainly more than the person that you know, is attracted to it, or, you know, that I'm consulting with, but I'm going to learn as I go too. So how would you differentiate
See, my thought is, yes, you can learn by teaching. I mean, you know, teaching others is a great way for you to learn it. And we'll talk about that coming up in the next segment, from the book about how to learn in our Cycles to Mastery approach. Mm-hmm. And so I think that definitely is a thing. But the fundamental issue is you've got to have depth of knowledge. I mean, to really make a difference, you've really got to get some depth of knowledge, which means you got to make some commitments. And I'm not saying you can do it with everything. You can keep convenience in certain areas of your life where you just basically skip over the surface. But somewhere in your life, have at least one thing during 2019 where you're going to go deep, where you're going to really struggle. You're going to try and fail and do it again and do it again and learn and really learn something, become immersed in it. And as part of that process, then start to teach others. Yes, if that's your desire. But if we don't commit ourselves to something, then we're just like androids. I mean, we're just like robots going around. You know, as he says, a life of total efficient conformity. I mean, my God, how boring is that? You know, we've got to take ourselves and say, I'm going to commit to something. I'm going to learn this thing. I'm going to master this thing. I mean, that's why, you know, we teach a fundamentals course in innovation engineering, and then we have mastery. And mastery is mastery. People are like, well, can I do it quick? No, it's mastery, damn it. Did you see the name? You know, where you really have to put some time in, and you got to get some practice, and you got to apply it, and you got to do it. But this world of, you know, simple and fast things is not doing it. Now, and I'm just going to preemptively say it. Now, you might say, well, geez, yeah, your whiskey, you're making your whiskey fast instead of old. Well, yeah, but there's no value add to slow. Okay. I mean, it is what it is. The mastery here is the process of putting your own together. You got to do a whole lot of permutations, and you got to spend some time on it. And we've got, in our case, we've got 24 variables we have to mess with. You got to put some time in. You got to pick something that you're going to be great at.
And so how do you know whether you've achieved it or not?
It doesn't matter. It's never ending.
Yeah, I get that, but
there is no achievement. I mean, you keep doing it.
Well, what's
because it's for the love of learning, and it's for the love of mastery and learning a new thing. And I mean, Margaret England, a wonderful artist, she's in her 80s. She makes incredible art. And when I see her in Prince Edward Island, my question to her, what's new? And she's like, well, I'm trying this new thing now. And she's trying something new. That's being alive. That's not a life of total efficient conformity. It's never ending.
No, I get the fact it's never ending. What I'm saying is this thought process that seems to be alive today of fake it until you make it type of a mentality, I think can be very destructive. So what my question is along the line of a kind of a continuum, if I don't know and I am faking it until I make it, which I think is not totally a good path to go, is there a definitive point where you could say, I've got enough mastery now that I can talk about this? How might one know?
See, I'm fine with it no matter where you are, as long as you're transparent about it.
Yeah, that therein lies part of the problem, I think. But a lot of the people,
I mean, it's just like whiskey. Yeah. I mean, we tell people how we make it with time compression. As long as you're transparent, I'm fine with anything.
Yeah.
It's when you purport and put on airs that I've got a frustration with it. Say, I can learn from somebody who's just learning. Hey, help me learn this. I'm cool with that. And I'm cool with working with Walter Werner, a true master at systems thinking, and learning from him. Mm. You know, either way, I'm good. I'm good. Just so long as you're transparent. To me, that's the key.
Okay. And I think that would probably be a good filter for some of the people that are out there. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor, Doug Hall. Well, let's move to our Driving Eureka book segment, A New Way of Learning Cycles to Mastery. Now, I'm really interested in this because I'm interested in how you went about putting together, because you know, I don't want to steal your thunder away from here, but, you know, especially as you got into some of the R&D and putting together your Cycles to Mastery training program, you go through these six things, brought up multiple questions. So I'm going to let you speak on it first. So I'm probably going to have lots of questions associated sure. with it about how it was developed and how does this fit? You know, well, let's talk, because we, in our last newsletter, you talked about, you know, narrative and aim and those things. How did this fit the narrative, first of all, of the what the ranch was doing, and then kind of how it formed from there might be a good place to take people.
So our mission at the ranch is to change the world through systems that enable innovation by everyone, everywhere, every day. And as we started to take our courses out, our innovation engineering courses to campus and executive training, what we found is that adults had different perspectives. Some, you know, innovation is one of those things where you make a decision in life. I can do it or I can't do it. Mm-hmm. And faculty on campuses feel like they can do it or they can't do it. I mean, it's the same thing. And so as we started to expand, we ran into all kinds of problems, all kinds of issues. And we needed to accomplish our mission. We needed to find a way to enable everybody to learn how to innovate with increased speed and decreased risk. How could we help everybody do it? And the existing system of teaching, as they call it, a sage on stage, preaching, people doing some things and then tests to find the smart ones and the dumb ones. You know, my job was not to find the smart ones and the dumb ones. My plan was to enable everybody to be able to do it, to enable everybody to do it. And so it was Jake Ward of the University of Maine. He was at a session we were doing. We were helping out the College Board on some stuff. And he said, Doug, I think we're going to have to invent a whole new way of teaching. I said, well, I don't know anything about teaching. He says, yeah, but I don't know that anybody else does. You've got a system, so use your system to invent it. You know, and that's one of those things where you go, damn it, I wish he hadn't said that. you know, and so, you know, to our point of going deep, you know, we looked at this and we said, you know, inventing a new way of teaching people, like, I need this like a hole in the head, right? Where do you begin? And we had a method for doing it. And so I said, I think this is important. And so literally it took us 2 years to start to put this thing together, and we're still working on it, but it took 2 years really to get to a first prototype that was anything. And we read the literature, we ran experiments. I mean, our goal was, how can we enable that everybody, I don't care who you are, you can innovate. And we took the work of Benjamin Bloom on the Two Sigma problem, formative assessment, Deming PDSA cycle, quality control charting, flipped classroom, a whole bunch of different parts we put together. And we created this system called Cycles to Mastery. And we guarantee that if you are willing, you can achieve mastery. And it's a collection of steps. The first is a digital class. So we broke the class, the innovation engineering curriculum, into skills and sub-skills, just like they have with advanced placement courses. And on campus, each week you do a skill. There's a skill every week, and there's 48 skills in the total curriculum over a number of courses. Do a digital class with 7-minute videos that cover each – there's one for each sub-skill. You watch those. You take a no-stress quiz at the end of it, which is formative assessment. It gives us a sense if they're getting it or not. Then they do a lab class of some replications of applying it, and then an application class where we take it into a broader thing, and we take not just that skill but the things you'd learned the week before and the week before, and we bring it all together so that you see how it fits into the whole. And then there'll be a reflection class that you write, where you write a reflection on what you learned and why it matters, which helps solidify learning, the literature shows. And then there will be experience classes. So the classic class on campus is digital, lab, application, and reflection. And you put in assignments, and the faculty gives you feedback, and you can resubmit and resubmit and resubmit until you get it right. Because our goal is not to test you to say you got it or you didn't, but to keep challenging you until you master that element. Because every element we teach is important. And then there'll be segments. If it's a class, you might have 8 weeks of skills, and then you might have a 4 week experience where we give you a real world challenge to have you now put it together. So, you know, you've learned it in digital, you've done it in lab, you've done it in application, you've written a reflection. Now you start to do it. I mean, you got five times through this skill. You really, 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 really learn this stuff. You really learn it. And if you get it wrong, you're given feedback. And the job of the faculty is to help you get it. That's what we're here for, is to help you get it. And I, as I said in the newsletter, and I wrote in the Driving Eureka book, in retrospect, the decision to invest the time, energy, and money to invent a new system of teaching is probably the most important decision we have made. It's enabled us to have a scalable system for truly democratizing innovation across entire companies, countries, and cultures. That's going deep, man. That's going deep. We had to build the tool to teach the stuff we wanted to teach. That's going deep.
So the innovation engineering system is using this methodology. Just out of curiosity, is the University of Maine, are they trying to build their classes other than innovation engineering around this, what you've learned, or what's the outreach of this?
So we've got it on campus. We've got about a dozen schools, and we're about to expand to 100 or 200 more this year. And you know, we help schools because we give all kinds of scholarships to make it so that they can afford to do it, make it very cost efficient for students to do it. It's subsidized heavily. And so we're using it for innovation engineering. We've had conversations with people about using this as a method of teaching other courses. Mm-hmm. And we've got discussions going on with some people, and some companies are starting to use it. But we're so focused against our mission, which is we're not in the education systems business selling that, that we're using it for our means. And I mean, one day we'll probably do some other stuff. But right now we're very focused on changing the world through systems that enable innovation by everyone, everywhere, every day. And this is a key tool to doing it.
Okay. And yeah, so I'm just kind of curious. I mean, I'm familiar with some of these things, but you list six things here that are part of it, of the cycles to mastery. You mentioned the work of Benjamin Bloom on the two sigma problem, which I'm going to ask you about in a second, the formative assessment, Deming-PDSA cycles, which we've talked about before, quality control charting, flipped classroom, and competency-based learning. Let's just pick a couple of these. The one I'm probably most curious, because I'm not familiar with the work, is of Benjamin Bloom and the two sigma problem. What are we referencing there?
So Benjamin Bloom famously wrote a thing called the Bloom Taxonomy, and it's well known in academic circles. But he also did a thing called the Two Sigma Problem, which was a way to figure out a way to help students who couldn't get it. And he ran experiments with tutoring, where a student that didn't get it was given feedback and to do it again and again and again. And he found that he could get 80% of the students to the level of the top 20% normally. Mm-hmm. So a mega improvement. People could learn. And when I read the article, what it sounded to me like was a plan, do, study, act cycle. And it really impressed me. The problem with Bloom's approach towards tutoring is it was extremely expensive to have one-on-one tutoring. And so I said, what if I use that as a foundation and using the digital tools in our way to help us get scale? And since then, we've built all kinds of things that have helped make it so it's much more efficient. But the foundation of what we're doing is Bloom's, you know, he had a fancy name for it, expert tutoring or interactive tutoring, or there was some name that he had with it, which I can't remember at the time. But that's the basis, which is, to me, it's a PDSA cycle. Plan, do, study, act, do it again, do it again, do it again until you master it.
Yeah, that really flies in the face of the way our education system is set up today. So because it's kind of the schedule is rigid, but the quality is flexible. So and I get that, and I don't want to take credit for that. That was a David Langford quote from one of my Deming podcasts. But you know, he said, and the reverse needs to be true, that the quality is fixed and the schedule needs to be flexible. Meaning, And the analogy I use, Doug, on this is we got kids now, you know, growing to engineering schools and law schools and, you know, schools to be doctors and things of that sort. And then they flunk out of a class. It could be calculus. It might be something like that. And then they're out. That's it. You know, yep. You can take it again and keep, you know, it's kind of like, you know, keep beating yourself on, you know, in the head with a hammer until you can, because nothing's changed in the system. You're still educating the same way. And this person or group of people, because I know, for instance, at Purdue, you know, like only the guy I ran into at Purdue said only 28% really passed the calculus class. And that's their way of weeding them out. I'm sitting there saying, do we have a huge shortage of engineers? Do we really want to not allow our baby to go from, you know, crawl to walk?
That drives me crazy that they'll, you know, faculty on campus will use math. You know, oftentimes they'll use math to weed people out. And I'm like, isn't your job to teach all these people? You know,
these are
aim of the system. Yeah, the aim of the system to find the smart ones and the dumb ones.
Yeah.
Well, for Christ's sakes, I don't need you as a teacher. I can just give them a test to figure that out if you want. No, your job is to enable these people to learn it. And in fact, that's what students say about ours is they say, you're here to help us. That's very different than in most classes where they're here to judge us.
No, I agree. And that's one thing I found refreshing about taking the innovation engineering classes is, yeah, no, you don't necessarily, it's not easy to pass when you go through your things, but you know, you keep getting feedback from, you know, teacher and Brad. He sits over there in the back of the classroom and he's evaluating, you know, and I finally figured out that he was kind of the wizard behind the curtains. he's back there.
A lot of the grading. And the thing is, so here's the rest of that.
Yeah.
He's not just his opinion. He has grading standards.
Oh, yeah.
Is right, what is wrong, and feedback. In other words, we've systematized the grading so that you have a student take it there, you take it down at the University of Alabama, you take it up in Oregon, wherever you take the class, you're graded by the same standards there is. You know, that's a remarkable concept, the idea of standardization of grading in college courses is something that is almost – it's like non-existent.
Right. Well, it also then provides feedback to – what you're missing in your teaching and making that better. But it's just the whole process is very interesting to me, as far as I'd not experienced anything like that until I went to the innovation engineering classes. And it was an interesting experience, but
you can learn it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. No, and it definitely
can do this. I mean, come on.
Yeah. If I can do this, anybody can do it.
Is creating ideas. Give me a break, guys. You know, there's no excuses for not learning stuff. There's no excuses.
Yeah. And this is an opportunity to go deep on innovation. All right. Well, let's move to our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. The topic here, great companies, great distilleries go deep. And you say to have a great company, you need to go deep on something. Well, this is kind of your theme that you've talked about here overall in your January 24th newsletter. You've spoken about going the need for people to go deeper. So how's this playing out in a distillery?
Well, it's not dissimilar to last week's when we talked about mission. You know, you've got that mission. Now let's do the work, you know, get in on something. And in the case of, you know, a whiskey distillery, it's what's going to make you meaningfully unique. Okay, so you got this mission, but what's going to be your defining point of difference? What are you going to really do that's different? And in our case, what we came to when we thought about enabling people with different whiskeys, we thought, okay, there's different things we could do. We could distill it differently. We could use different grains. Yeah, okay, we could do some grains. We could do really weird grains and buckwheat and things that aren't normally done, or heritage grains or organic grains, and we could do those. But when we looked at it, you know, 70% of the flavor of a whiskey comes from the wood. It is the wood and the interaction of the lignans in the wood with the spirit that creates the thing that we know as a whiskey, the color and the flavor. And so we decided that we were going to go deep on wood. We were going to know wood like nobody in the world knows wood. Now, part of this came from my background. I'd spent, you know, over 20 years working with Edrington that makes the Macallan, who are masters of wood with regards to, in particular, European sherry oak, which is why Macallan has its incredible luxury, you know, just like nothing else. It's also the most expensive whiskey in the world because of that. And so I understood the value of wood from that. And so we just went into wood. And so we built our system so that we could test as quick and fast as possible. So whether it's using old oak, new oak, Japanese oak, European oak, you know, Canadian oak, whether it's using maple or cherry or chestnut or walnut, generally hardwoods is what you use, whether it's toasting it in different ways, from a light toast to a char. And I said, we just need to know wood better than anybody else in the world needs wood. And we could do it very rapidly with time compression. So we ran over 2,000 experiments and ran over 500 consumer taste tests to deepen our learning. So, I mean, that's called going deep, you know. We went all in on the wonder of wood. And so, I mean, we get it. We get it. We decided to not distill, but to buy raw spirit. I mean, we could distill, but, you know, I just looked at the math. I said, the value add that you make, if I make it, you know, other than which grain you use, which is maybe 25% of it, maybe 5% of it is, do you run your still cool? I mean, it's like I said before, it's not making beer. It's doing spirits, where it's the whiskey maker who puts the barrels together that really creates the flavors that we know as whiskey. And so, you know, that's what we did, is we went deep on wood. And wood is the way, and the different treatments of wood, whether it's old world or new world, that's our means to deliver on customizing your whiskey, because you basically become a wood master when you do our stuff. Because you can be a distiller and you can be a fancy distiller, but that's not going to have an impact on what you get in the glass. I understand people love distilling, and I'm cool with that. If that's your thing, rock on. For us, we can't get the differences from the distilling that we can get with wood to give people really different tasting bourbons, giving people really different tastings, ryes or barleys or wheats or whatever it is that we might be doing. I mean, that's where, and for our mission, wood was the thing that we went deep on, and we've gone deep. And I'll be honest with you, we may have gone even further than we needed to go. Because we've got compulsive about it, and I had to pull the team out and just say, ship, 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 you know, because we are addicted to knowing more about that wood. I mean, the work we do inspecting wood and checking wood and evaluating it is compulsive, because our process goes so fast. We have to have impeccable quality. So we are, I mean, no one is as fanatical about wood as we are, because wood is where the flavor comes from.
So, Doug, the question that comes up when I hear you say that is, the, you know, there's only so much wood, right? I mean, you know, you have to find a wood that there is an abundance of to be able to make, you know, consistent whiskey, you know, over a period of time. In other words, if it's a rare wood, that's great. You're going to get a taste, but you may only have enough to make 50 cases or something like that. Is that?
Well, it's different. It's different things if you're doing it. I mean, okay. In the whiskey business, one of the things that's great is limited editions. And so there is a virtue when I get some very special wood that a person has, or we find, you know, like we've got some 200-year-old wood in one of our products from an old barn that had fallen down, and we reclaimed the wood, cleaned the outside and cut it up and charred it. And so we can give an amazing taste with that. But they can be limited editions.
Okay. So, you know, it's real scarcity.
There's plenty, and it doesn't take much wood to do a bottle of whiskey. It's just not a lot of wood. So there's no real, you know, it's not like cutting down trees to make barrels. I mean, it's pretty easy. In fact, we can use barrels. We can cut barrels up and do it. I mean, we do that with our noble oak product, is we take European sherry oak and we cut the barrels up and use that.
Okay. But you said that, what was the percentage? You said 70% of the flavor comes from the
70%. Wood? Yeah, that's pretty much what the experts will tell you. 70% is the wood. And the skill of the whiskey maker putting the barrels together. You know, if you had barrels at the top of the warehouse versus the bottom of the warehouse, they're going to age differently, and they'll have in, you know, center of the building versus the edges of the building. And so the skill to put that together in that wood, that's 70%. Probably 20-25% is the grain choice. Wheat tastes different than rye, which tastes different than corn, which tastes different than bourbon, which tastes different than barley. And probably 5% is the distiller. Now that's assuming that the distiller does their job. Now, if they do it badly, that ruins everything. But if you make a dirty spirit that isn't very good, then that's a different issue. But assuming that you're competent at what you're doing, the value add in whiskey, unlike beer, is not the distiller. It is the whiskey maker, who manages the barrels and puts together the whiskeys.
And you mentioned this before, but basically your whiskey maker then uses the innovation engineering system to go through these cycles of learning and mastery associated with your whiskeys. Do I have that right?
Yeah, which is no different than a chef making something and then trying four or five different versions on it to see which one customers like the best. We just happen to do the same thing, and we do it with quantitative research. So it's the same thing.
Okay.
It's that never-ending learning. How can I make the product better?
Okay, good. All right, well, let's talk about the Classic Rocks serve. You threw a little bit of a curveball at me here. I'm usually looking for the next drink. This is not really about that per se. It's about whiskey and putting ice and water in it.
Yeah, so, you know, only about 20% of people that drink whiskey drink it neat. Despite all the noise on it, they make a lot of noise, 80%. They add ice, water, or mixers with it. So most whiskey, over 80% of whiskey, is consumed with something in it. I happen to like it with ice. And so this week, while we're talking about going deep and talking about wood, I said this was the week when we had to not do anything to get in the way of the whiskey. Now, that said, I'd still put some ice in, fill the glass about half full, use our Noble Oak product that I've been talking about, our Noble Oak bourbon, you know, Double Gold in San Francisco, 95 score, ultimate challenge. And just, you know, put some ice in, stir it, you know, a dozen times or so, and just sip and savor that thing. And you're going to get, you've got the new American oak for the bourbon, then the European sherry oak. So it's this kind of wonderful depth. So sometimes bourbons can be kind of shrill. They can be kind of one-dimensional and very corny, as in the flavor corn. Here you're going to get just a richness and a character. Some people have said to me, it's got, I'm stereotyping, which is not fair because there are products that are not, but bourbons oftentimes are kind of one dimensional. Scotches are oftentimes, richer in flavor, but the scotches can also be somewhat dirtier. There can be some smoke and from the peat, and there can be also the barley can be a bit gnarly, as we say. And at the same time, it'll be a lot cleaner with the bourbon. And so what we're trying to do is we do clean but rich. So a way to think of this is by mixing these two woods, we're getting a fusion of the cleanness of a bourbon, but with a richness without the gnarliness of a scotch. It's not really, because it is still a bourbon, but the double wood here really puts a depth of character in the sherry oak wood, which, you know, those barrels cost like 50 times more than regular bourbon barrels do, ex-bourbon barrels.
Hmm. Okay. And what was Doug, I think in one of the previous Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segments, you talked about you put the ice in for 7 minutes And that's kind of the optimal time. I don't know if you were just messing with me or if that was a real thing.
Yeah, but. No. So what happened is I like it with ice, mm-hmm. and it's craft distillery. So craft people make choices and you make what you love and then you take it to the world. That's how we do it. We do the testing to optimize, but if we don't like it, we don't put it into a test. It's that's just kind of the way it is. We're doing it. And so what we ended up with is we added a little over 20% more square inches of wood per bottle. So if you look at a barrel, there's so many square inches of wood divided by the number of bottles of spirit are inside. And we took it up a little bit, and then we adjusted the compression that we did, and we made it such that oftentimes with whiskeys, in particular bourbon sometimes, and scotches, some of them will, they'll fall apart. If you add ice to it, the flavor drops off real quick. Mm. It just goes right off a cliff. And we wanted it to have with ice, and so we made it with extra wood. And so the result is you taste it and it's good, but it gets better over about 7 minutes, and then it starts down the other side. And so the second sip is better than the first, and the third will be better than the second. It's a little bar trick that we do with people. We say, now try it, now wait a little bit, now try it again. And it actually gets better with ice. And that's designed into the product. That's there for a reason. We did that on purpose.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, this episode is prior to your distillery opening this weekend. So the next time we talk in your newsletter, you'll be able to talk to the opening of your distillery this weekend. Is there anything you want to say about the opening?
No, I'd rather not talk about that.
Okay,
because may or may not be officially opening. We may be running an R&D experiment.
Oh, okay.
So, it may be a quiet pipe opening.
Okay, I got you. All right. Well, you remember one of our segments was about patience, right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, go deep. Hopefully everybody takes that to heart.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay to have convenience, but if you're going to use the convenience and it frees you up, what's it going to free you up to then go do? You know, all these people spend this time to free you up. So they freed you up. Now, what are you going to do with it because of that? What are you going to do with your life? Get up, get out, get going. That's what I'm telling you to do.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you, Doug. Look forward to your next newsletter.
Excellent.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for limited time four things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.